Attorney Anderson. This case, in our view, is about a gift. It is a gift that was given to the respondent in the state of Wisconsin by the district court. When the district court dismissed this case based on a defense that the state didn't have. The state didn't have that defense because it had waived that defense. The district court dismissed this case because the petition for habeas corpus was filed too late. At the time the petition was filed, no one thought it was too late. The petitioner didn't think it was too late, and indeed, the respondent didn't think it was too late.
Do you think a district court could dismiss a case for failure to exhaust state remedies if the state had not contended that there were remedies still to exhaust?
Yes, but I think that that is something that involves an issue of comity between the federal courts and the state courts that isn't really involved
Every
here.
Every collateral attack involves an issue of comity between the federal courts and the state courts.
I grant
federal
you that...
Federal courts are being asked to upset a final judgment of state courts. There's very little beside comity at stake here.
There are many cases in which federal courts have declined
I raise this, you may know, because the Supreme Court has held, in a case called Granberry against Greer, on review from this very circuit, that district courts are free to raise exhaustion even though the state has affirmatively waived exhaustion. Unlike here, where one would say the state forfeited its limitations defense. And I have a hard time seeing why there would be a difference between exhaustion and limitations for purposes of collateral review.
There are two levels of answer. There is a level of answer that is more fact-specific to this specific case. There is a level of answer that is more generic. Let me do the generic one first, because that's where I think you want me to go.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that the exhaustion of remedies is something that is, look, you haven't utilized the resources available to you in the state that could have got you that answer, and there's an element of affront, if you will, to the state judicial system when the federal court system lets it be used to upset a state judgment which, had it been properly presented to the state system, the state might have upset on its own. And that's not polite. Whereas here, you've got a situation in which all we're talking about is timing. And if the state doesn't have an objection to the federal court hearing the case, we're not talking about...
I don't understand why that's not true equally of exhaustion. If the state, which is the state attorney general representing the state interest, does not have an objection based on exhaustion, what's the problem? One, of course, could have said that. In fact, our court did say that in Granberry.
The problem is that we're not just talking about the state, i.e. the litigant. We're talking about the state, the entity that maintains the judicial system. The concept, I believe, behind the various ideas of exhaustion is that we ought first to require the litigant to resort to the state court system, that we should not assume the state court system can't handle the job of protecting the constitutional rights of the accused. We should not intervene to upset a state court judgment where the resource available in the state court system hasn't been utilized by the accused to vindicate his federal constitutional rights. That's not true here. That's not an issue that we've got here, because here there's not a question, at least yet at this stage, about failure to utilize the state court system. This went through all of the different levels. This is a situation in which, but for the issue of the timing of the filing of the petition, this would be a classic case in which there's no question that there's a right to look at this in a federal court. This is a situation in which we don't cast doubt on a state judicial process and its ability to resolve federal constitutional rights when we haven't utilized that process to try to vindicate those rights. We have, it hasn't, and we're now in a situation in which the state and the defense, and this actually gets to the second, to the fact-specific level, and it goes back to why it's a gift. Petitioner makes a mistake as to the timing. the state makes a mistake, the identical mistake, as to the timing of what the statute of limitations is. This court doesn't decide how to count that.
Let's assume that we think that this issue will be resolved similarly to Granberry, that the district court has the power to do this. It ought to use the power intelligently, but it has the power to consider this even if the state didn't raise it. Now, the state has confessed error on the merits of the timeliness question. And I was puzzled by the fact that your reply brief essentially declines to rely on the state's confession of error. Is there some logical problem in the state's reasoning about the meaning of 2244D1A?
How are you referring to the state having confessed error? I grant that the
state said the district judge incorrectly understood 2244D1A. It asked for affirmance on other grounds, but it disagrees with the district court's interpretation of the period of limitations. It's done that before in other cases, and this circuit has resolved the other cases without reaching that issue. I'm puzzled by the fact that you don't embrace their reading. Do you agree with it, disagree with it, or just want us not to reach it?
If you are submitting that the state is suggesting that the district court misread Gutierrez, and that the state is acknowledging that the period of limitations is what we originally thought it was, I don't read the state that way. I think that the parties are acknowledging that Gutierrez sets the statute of limitations. I think the state's acknowledging that when it originally figured what the statute was wrong, it was wrong, just as the petitioner is wrong.
Well, the state can tell me for sure what it thinks. But I had read their brief as saying that 2244D1A excludes from the time counted against the year the time when the defendant could have sought review in the Supreme Court of the United States and did not.
If that is the...
And if that time is excluded, I believe, your case
timely.
Is timely.
I would accept that confession.
That's what I understood the state to say. Now, that's why I was so puzzled by your reply brief not saying, hooray, we're finally in agreement.
If I had read it that way, and if I misread it, I certainly apologize. If I had read it that way, I would have said, hooray, we're in agreement.
Well, they asked for affirmance of the judgment on other grounds, so you're not in agreement on that.
True.
They asked for affirmance of the judgment on the ground that you have studiously refused to make any constitutional argument of any kind.
No, we haven't. We haven't made it here. We don't view it. But I could devote the transcripts in this case are a stack that's approximately this high off the table. There hasn't been any litigation beyond pleading stage in the district court, and quite candidly, I can't see any interpretation of the probable cause certificate requirement that makes sense that would require this court to have us brief and indeed address issues that aren't ripe for adjudication, haven't been
decided.
Other
than the fact that the Supreme Court of the United States said in SWAC against McDaniel that that's what has to happen?
Your Honor, I think that the probable cause requirement is a jurisdictional requirement that's
a
type of issue.
It's not a jurisdictional requirement, we've so said.
It is, as I understand it, Your Honor, a requirement that there be, in fact, a substantial constitutional issue. The Owens case, which the district court relied upon in granting that certificate of appealability, Owens versus Boyd, which is...
What the Supreme Court said in SLAC is that a statutory issue, some non-constitutional procedural issue, may be argued in the Court of Appeals, not on its own, but pendant to the argument of a substantial constitutional issue. Now, you may disagree with SLAC, but it is what nine justices of the Supreme Court agreed on.
And this court, in fact, in Boyd, reached the issue of a statutory procedural issue, despite the fact that it did not, in that certificate of appealability, even have a constitutional issue, and it did so on the predicate that it was not jurisdictional. And it did that in 2000.
We said that if the state sleeps on its rights, we're not going to rescue it. But the state of Wisconsin has not slept on its rights here.
Actually, it certainly has.
Not on this question.
Not perhaps on this question. I would certainly agree with that. But that, Your Honor, I believe is an issue not of this court's power to reach the issue. Indeed, it makes no sense to convert this court into the first court to decide the underlying. There are many cases in which a taking of evidence.
I can appreciate disagreeing with Slack, but we're an inferior court. We do what the Supreme Court tells us.
I am aware that courts refer to themselves as inferior only under those circumstances.
No, only because the Constitution referred to us as
inferior. That's what the Constitution calls us.
It's bothered me all my life. But I mean,
my response, Your Honor, and as my time is up, I will then conclude, is that I do not believe that the Supreme Court can reasonably be construed to be putting on this court the job of determining habeas corpus petitions on their merits in the first instance, when in fact all that is normally ripe for appellate review in the circumstances is a procedural issue unrelated to the constitutional claim, which has got the litigants into this court. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Walford?
May it please the court, I'm William C. Wolford, representing the appellee John Litcher in this case. The state did not raise the statute of limitations in its answer to the habeas petition in this case because it believed that the petition was timely.
So I am correct to say that you've confessed error on the district court's reading of 2244D1A.
Well, we do not believe that that issue has been resolved in this circuit, but we believe that the interpretation that we proposed in our brief is correct,
and
that's the one adopted by other
circuits. The same interpretation you proposed in Johnson against McQuadry, and of course we ducked in Johnson. There were procedural problems in Johnson. Maybe there are procedural problems here, but okay. But I do correctly understand your position on 2244D1A, and you have the virtue, I think, for which you deserve our praise, of being consistent in your view of that statute, even though your view is not in the state's interest.
And it is our position that the magistrate judge erred in relying on Gutierrez because that case dealt with 2244D2 rather than D1. And this is a case that involves direct review under D1. Our reasons supporting our interpretation are the language of D1, cases such as Griffiths versus Kentucky and Bearslet versus Estelle. And we believe the reasoning in the other circuits that have reached that same conclusion are sound. However, it's our position that even though the magistrate judge erred in ruling that the petition was not timely, the dismissal of the habeas corpus case here should be affirmed because the appellant waived or forfeited his rights because he didn't raise the constitutional issues. This court can affirm the denial.
This is not, at least in this circuit, it is in some other circuits, but in this circuit, this is not a jurisdictional limitation. Why, in your view, should we reach this non-jurisdictional ground of affirmance rather than finally resolving what's proved to be a pretty elusive question about the meaning of 2244D1A? Here we are. We're now closing in on 6 years after this statute was adopted. Shouldn't we finally pin it down if we can do so without exceeding our jurisdiction?
Well, I certainly agree it's not jurisdictional, and
in this circuit,
and perhaps there's a way for the court to address both issues. Decide this question, which certainly does need deciding, but still rule that the judgment should be affirmed because of waiver or forfeiture, because the constitutional issues were not briefed.
Whoa. It may not be jurisdictional, but we're not in the advisory opinion business.
Well, I guess
if we're going to decide it, I assume we'll actually decide it.
You indicated that we took a position that was contrary to our interests as far as the statute of limitations is concerned, and indeed we realize that that is true. However, it's also in our interest to have this case be over. So in that respect, we would like the case to be dismissed on the basis of waiver or forfeiture. And we think that the, as you point out, Slack versus McDaniel and Owens indicate that that should be the result.
Nothing further?
Nothing further unless there are further questions.
The silence is pregnant with possibility, but there is none.
Thank you, Mr. Wall. Yeah. We thank both counsel. The case is taken under advisement. Court will proceed.